Right, today is the 19th of February, 2009. I'm at the IGS offices in Dhaka, Bangladesh, with Mr. Rizwan Kaya, who is here on secondment from the civil service. Before I start the interview, can I ask that you give me your consent for this interview?
Yes.
Excellent. So, I'd like to talk to you about efforts at reform in the civil service and the administrative cadre in the Bangladeshi civil service. But first, could you tell me about what you do now and what jobs you've held that have brought you up to this position?
Oh, well, I started my career after passing the university. I worked in a private bank, working there for 4 years, and I sat for the civil service test. I entered the civil service. I worked in the field level administration. You know, I belong to the administration cadre, so I worked in the field level for some time, and then moved on to the ministry. I worked in the ERD, which is called the Economic Relations Division, with the Minister of Finance twice. Then after that, I also worked in a training academy. So I became interested as a trainer. I worked also in a training academy, which is called the Bangladesh Public Administration Training Center, which basically trains civil servants. I got interested and I moved on there. I worked twice there in the career for a long time. Pretty long time, I think 4 years, nearly 6 years there in two stints. And from 2006, I got the secondment from the government to work as the academic coordinator on the program on the IGS. Now, this program, which is called the Masters in Governance and Development, is basically a capacity building on the civil servants in Bangladesh. It's an academic program broadly designed to give the concepts and skills of governance and development for civil servants. So I look after the program, among other things. Also, as the academic coordinator of the center, I look after the other training program, lots of projects coming up, sort of giving inputs here and there. There's a research angle to the institute itself. I don't, oversee that, but, sometimes go and help out there. But it's more of academic activities of the center.
Thank you. So I'd like to talk about the challenges facing the civil service in Bangladesh and the attempts or efforts to introduce some reforms. So if you could start, could you talk about some of the issues and challenges that are facing the civil service and some of the reasons why reforms have been attempted?
I think the challenges are enormous, in a globalized world where the civil service now have to deal with a lot of issues, and they have to have different kind of skills that were needed even 10, 20, 30 years back. If you talk with the older civil servants, they'll give you one angle. But I think with the civil servants of today have to deal with many issues. There's a question of accountability, better governance, transparency, which were issues that were not, 20, 25 years, or even when I entered the civil service there. This is some question I ask my colleagues when I, go on a training session is, what do you think have changed over the number of years? They all come up to, after some time to come to conclusion, things have changed, things have moved on. That change is inevitable. But in a rapidly globalized world, changes are much more than, people could have conceived 20 years back. Because if you look at the public sector globally, the whole public sector management has changed, how the government operates. But unfortunately, in the context of Bangladesh, we haven't changed much. We are still based of the colonial model, given to us by the Britishers. And once you enter that structure, the so-called iron framework, your whole mentality changes. You go by processes, you go by rules and regulations. You become unresponsible to needs of the citizens. Somehow or other you come up with the concept that everything, what is best for the citizens. And I'm very sure that, you can find this kind of stuff in all over the world. Though there have been a lot of efforts, I won't say efforts, Also, a lot of initiatives have been taken. Okay, from 1972 to 2000, it was the last reform committee was in 2000, the park. If you look at the 1972 when the committee for administrative reforms committee was set up in 1972, if you look at that, there have been a lot of sort of a plethora of recommendations, but basically no major structural and procedural changes have been brought into play. Whatever the changes were there is mostly cosmetic, in the sense that a nip here and a tuck there, and it hasn't really helped to change the mindset of the civil service. And if you ask me right now, that's my basic assumptions. If you ask me right now, how many of the civil servants are able to cope up with the challenges in a globalized world? I wouldn't say even 90%, 95% wouldn't be able to, because they're stuck in the old mode. It's very difficult to get them out of that stuff. It's not that some of them don't realize that changes are, necessary, and they need to come up with, better skills for able to make them capable to meet those challenges. But somehow or other, that initiative is not taken by the government, or there's a wider resistance within the bureaucracy, and all bureaucracies are resistant to changes. If in my training sessions with them over Dabhavnagar, I discuss reforms with them. This is one of my classes that I take. It's when I say to them, these are the things that people are doing outside. Look at India, look at Malaysia, look at Singapore, look at Pakistan, or look at the neighboring countries. What's happening? What's the reflections of global changes? They said, that's not India, we are not Pakistan, we are not Singapore. But they do realize there is a need to change. But the problem is that that's not our job. Who's going to take a decision? It's a politician's decision to take the change. But I think that there's a growing consensus, at least within the junior levels, there's a need to change. But how to bring about the changes has become as problematic. How do you change? I keep telling them, there's no need to change radically. Changes are always incremental, and it should always be homegrown. The problem with all these committees and commissions is that people within the bureaucracy have a feeling that these are all consultant based. Okay, and then there's something that flies from the outside, donor pushed. Donor-driven. So there is a resistance within the bureaucracy to change and to maintain the status quo. That's obviously a big problem. But I would say there's a growing consensus within the civil service. It's not reached critical mass till now. When I teach in that class, I show them a diagram, a balloon with arrows. I say there is a consensus. We're growing among the junior civil servants. Some sort of changes are necessary. They agree with that. But somehow or other, if you put in 10 years, 20 years of life, you also tend to have sort of a group feeling. If we take this, we are going to be affected, that kind of stuff. And I think that also boils down to the problem that, the rewards and punishment is not performance-based. That's very crucial. Because rewards and punishments are, people get promoted on the basis of a batch or a group or a seniority. Okay, the merit is not a question. And skills are not a question. So, whichever batch comes first gets promoted. Like if you find today newspapers today, you'll find around 62 deputy secretaries have been promoted to the post of joint secretaries. I have got doubts how many of them are capable enough to man their post. This group have been, let's promote them. So it's that kind of criteria that's quite important. Another thing is that I hear this thing about the senior civil, very, very senior, even retired ones too. See, seniority in Bangladesh civil service is based on a concept of you sit for one exam and then your seniority is fixed forever. But, there are people who pick up skills later on, okay? And, people who become the first, in a serial list, might not do anything, might not pick up any skills in 20, 25 years of service that he or she puts in, but sends by the dint of one stupid exam, which is also, you know, you can't really justify this thing, because that's really not scientific in the sense that, like I keep telling, I have questions about the exam system, like if you're from a pure science background or a mathematical background, you tend to score more in the next exam, because in those kind of subjects, you know, the scoring is, the band is higher. But if you come from social science, economics, the tendency in public universities in that kind of exam is, well, you just give first class marks. The highest you get is 60, which is, you know, not even equivalent to something like that, 80 plus. So with a 60 and someone who scores with a math background, that person comes up with the 85. It doesn't really make sense. You know, you can't really judge the merit of two persons on the same plate. So that the exam system itself is faulty. What could have been done, it was done previously, is that, you know, exam could be a part of the seniority. The other part of seniority could have been, you know, your performance, your training, all taken together. And the seniority, one person did not senior forever, you know, that seniority is based on the performance. If you could have done that, there would have been a possibility that, you know, you would have kept, you know, you vet and you get, you skim people to the top, you got fast-track people. But there's no fast-track system in the context of Bangladesh. There have been talks about what you call the senior service pool, but there's a lot of discussions how to do it, who's going to be there and all that. Once a senior
What is a senior service pool?
Senior service pool is like this executive service, senior executive service, you know, of the states. In the USA, there's called the senior executive service, SES, I think. It's supposed to, people are supposed to sit for an exam and get, you know, in that sort of pool where you get fast-tracked, promoted based on your performance and better, you know, more skill training. It's supposed to be there, but it's not happened over a number of years. It was initiated back in 1978-79. It was there. The name of was senior management pool. It was there from 79 to 89. But there was no exam was held. You know, people entered the pool on the best, on the basis of seniority. So you don't have merit there. If you look at the history, you'll find out this is cropping up. So I mean, I would say that if you'll ask me one blunt question, is the present generation of civil servants equipped to face challenges 20 years, 15 years down the line? Are we able to compete with other civil servants in the region? I would say no. Because though we have the, you know, basic skills, these skills have not been upgraded. Okay, and skills need, like, look at the armed forces, they have continuous grading, you know, skills enhancement, which we don't have. For example, you know, after entering civil service, you have to go to this foundation course. You know, when I entered, I did my foundation course, it was nearly 2 years before after I entered the service. By that time, the foundation course becomes totally irrelevant. You know, you learn things you already know, then you learn other stuff. So, training is, and if training is linked up with your career, that is makes sense. Training is not linked up with your career management. There's no career planning system in the civil service there. Recently, the government has opened what is called career planning and training wing in the Ministry of Establishment. You know, they're supposed to give inputs to the government for how to, you know, on career planning, but there's absolutely no plan down there. And they're helpless with the other wing that is there in the planning establishment ministry, the APD, Appointment Planning and Deputation. It's APD who decide who goes where. I mean, people have been shouting for ages, like, people who have come back from study abroad, trained in a particular area, you oppose them in a particular department where they can utilize this training. I mean, there's no match of, you know, skills of posting. And APD decides on, you know, what people are needed where, and that's it. Where with the CPT, the Career Planning Training Section, or the wing, should have a far better say who goes where. You have to have, you know, right person in the right place. They absolutely have no say there.
So who established the career planning wing?
This was, I think, a lot of donors, and there was a lot of talk of there should be a career planning wing. And CPT was, the government itself did. They decided to have a career planning wing.
So would that have been in the Ministry of Establishment, or the Prime Minister would have made that decision?
Yeah. And the problem is you have to let CPT wing work and give proper inputs of deciding who goes where. Well, what happens when I come back from abroad? The CPT usually puts up a file that I've done this training and, you know, I should be placed in that departments or ministries. But in almost 99.99% of the cases, their recommendations are not looked into. It is the APD wing that decides who goes where.
So why does the APD not take this into account?
Well, it's what you call empire building. They're more powerful. They are very powerful. At one time, Joint Secretary APD was the most powerful Joint Secretary in the Ministry of Establishment. Because he was the one who decided who goes where. Now, decisions are, you know, taken higher up.
When was that changed?
Which decisions?
The decisions were moved up.
Well, it's by default. Okay. It's maybe sometimes it's political. Sometimes it's also a person who's manning the post. When I joined the service, a Joint Secretary APD was the person who's to do that. Now it's more of a political, not all the time. Many of the time it's politically says you place that person there and there. Or it's APD's wish to match him where there is existing vacancy. So APD, since it's has got that power, and CPT has not been able to, you know, really exercise its real functions. So that has become a problem. And, well, on the other question, I would say that if you think, you ask me whether they are capable civil service within the service existing, there are. There are. But what they need to be placed in the right place is one, and two is they have to be, they should be given the opportunity to show the skills. And then thirdly, they need to be, you know, the skills need to be honed up a little bit. A lot of junior ones who are pretty good, a lot of mid-level ones are pretty good, but unfortunately they don't get placed in the right places. Or they don't have an opportunity to show the skills. Okay, because the performance evaluation system is quite opaque. You know, my 21 years of service, I really don't know how much I've even got in my, you know, what you call the ACR. I've got a hunch.
It's the annual confidential report,
yeah,
right?
Nobody knows who's getting what.
So what sort of changes do the junior staff want to see?
Probably if you ask some of the junior staff, is basically, I don't know whether you have a chance to talk with you. I mean, they will probably want to see a clear-cut career progression. They'll probably want to see, rewards and punishment for performance. Okay. And many of them have, you know, come from the private sector where they were very well paid. And many of them would also want some good pay, which would motivate to stay them to stay in the public sector. Okay. Now, it is interesting, the public sector offers an opportunity for someone to really have a very interesting venues for working, sense that it is you can, if you're interested in doing public sector service, well, many will say, well, it's, the job is interesting, you know, that's why they don't. And I think the power is also a big thing. You do exercise a lot of power in the public sector, so the power is also another thing. But if you ask any junior what they want, they'll probably say a clear-cut career progression, incentives for performance. So they don't get frustrated at the end of 10 years, 15 years, saying, I'm not going anywhere. Why did you leave the, I got an email from someone I trained about 10 years back, or 12 years back in the training academy. And he sounded very frustrated. He said, what should I do? He wants to leave the service. I said, I just told him, just hang on for a little bit while. I mean, I couldn't tell him all that. That's it. But that doesn't really, also There is also, you'd find a lot of resistance within the civil servants. That is, resistance for changes to, you know, come. But I think that resistance can be overcome if political government has a very strong will to bring changes. It's you know, sort of a mismatch between the will and the sort of a growing consensus. It's not that we have reached a critical mass where the bureaucracy itself is able to push for changes. We haven't reached that for a lot of different reasons. Okay, we haven't really reached that. So there's resistance within. But I would say from working within the civil service, there is a consensus growing, which is growing consensus, I would say, that, you know, some changes are necessary, if not radical. I mean, what really wants needs to happen now is sort of a matching of that consensus with the political wing to get things going. That political will has been somehow missing. If you look at the, you know, reform efforts from 1972 till now, there's been no substantive political will to, you know, bring in those changes. And that is the reason probably changes did not come. And the bureaucracy, all bureaucracies resist changes. And bureaucracy, you know, played their part. I mean, you give a chance to bureaucracy, say no, they'll say no. And that's what happened in the context of Bangladesh. And another thing is that, you see, people from 72 to 2000, he had this old generations of, well, I'll give an example, which I'm very sure none of my seniors that you're going to interview are going to agree to. Maybe one or two might. I remember meeting this civil servant from India who was working as a consultant to ADB a long time back. And he told me, look, there's one difference, there's a lot of similarities between your civil service, your senior civil service, and ours. I says, what is that? The difference is that, he said, the Indian civil servants, senior, very senior ones, if they don't like something, they'll say, well, we don't like it. But the problem with your civil servant is that if they don't like something, they'll do everything in their power to see that things don't work out. Which, if my experience also shows that. I mean, things have not really worked because the senior civil servants were not on board all the time. They were not able, or they were not, you know, coming in terms that one point of their, you know, life they have to let the power go. And interestingly, I don't know, will every, once they come out of the civil service, they become big adherents for reform. Which is something the juniors question. What have you guys done so long? When you were in power, why haven't you guys changed? What have you done for us? And that's a burning question the juniors ask the seniors. What have you done for the rest of your juniors? They say that if you have initiated some changes, you would have benefited, but the country and we would have benefited. So why didn't you start initiating the change? We have tried to stop every thing that has come that way. Well,
so why have that?
Why have they? Well, they come from an old school of bureaucracy that believes, they think, and you know, power is probably one, and they, you know, power is not probably, power is the prime concern here. And basically, they thought that they knew better of how the country operated. And interestingly, many of them will find, nowadays, they'll find that they become big, you know, pushers for change within the civil service. And then there is a counter question within the civil service now: what have these old buggers done when they were in power?
So where would the reforms have come from that have been attempted?
Well, if from 72 it was a political initiative, nothing happened to it, interestingly. And the big ones that have been, all governments in power have initiated the, but the problem
political,
is
political government.
Yeah, but the problem is when you go to the intermission stage, it became just another book on the shelf. And interestingly, if you do a content analysis of things have been said in 1972, 73, and things that have been said in 2000, you'll find repetitions of stuff. So is maybe a repackaging of reforms with new ideas coming in. But the general idea has been there that the reforms must be initiated. There should be performance oriented. There should be a scope for high flyers to be, picked up and trained and put into appropriate positions. There should be, compensated appropriately. That kind of stuff is what has been there. If you look at the, if you do a content analysis of all the reform reports, it has happened all over the period. But nothing has happened. Well, but the academics will say it's the bureaucracy. Well, I agree there's a bureaucracy to a certain part, part has been largely behind of the resistance. But I think point the finger of blame to the politician masters. They have not really pushed it through. If you don't, you look at the reform efforts that have taken root in many countries in Southeast Asia, even South Asia, is the politicians who decided now a change is necessary. And when that decision is made, the bureaucracy somehow fall in the line, whether they like it or not. But in this case in Bangladesh, I think this has been a tendency to maintain the status quo, and as a result, nothing has happened.
So why have the politicians not been enthusiastic about reforms?
Probably my take on this thing is probably they want to maintain the status quo. They don't want to rock the boat too much. And, maintain things as they have been in the past.
And is there growing demand for reforms from other sectors?
Civil society, yes. I think there is a growing demand. People are becoming more aware of this kind of services. It's, there are grumbles within the civil society itself. Private sector also gripes about the bureaucracy not doing its part. Okay. I think the pressure from the public is also a bit absent, the general public as such. But I think the pressure is not there, but I think there's a growing awareness that things need to be changed. There's an awareness, but the pressure has not really built up in the citizens, among the citizens as such. That is probably another reason I think the politicians really haven't picked up on the idea of, this is getting too much. I think the gist is what's really happening.
Who are the reform commissions typically submitting their reports to?
To the government.
To the government, yeah. Not to parliament?
No.
So it's to the prime minister?
Yes, it's the government in power, the prime minister or the president, whoever, shape or reason. So what happens in most of the cases, they find when a reform report is given, a committee or commission is fine to examine that thing. And that becomes a cycle by itself. It never gets, to see the light of implementation. Well, the other problem that has been, if you look at the historical, the governments here get elected for 5 years. And if they don't undertake any reform efforts within the first 2 years, after the second year, they get focused on other things. So none of the government has done that, come up with a reform agenda within the two years. When the park was formed, the government did form the park commission right in the first couple of years. But the park took a long time to give its report. By this time, I think government had shifted its attention span somewhere. But even then, parks gave some interim recommendations to the government when this commission was going on. A lot of interim recommendations. But the problem with the interim recommendations, none of them were implemented by the government. If the government was serious enough, they could have done a lot of those things. But what they did is basically very simple stuff, which are, which are not actually noteworthy.
Like what?
Oh, there was one time that, you know, that you could, well, for example, travel tax that you, when you for air travel, long time before this used to be paid separately. Now that comes within the ticket itself. So that was one thing that was done right away. then things like highway patrol and stuff like that, you know, not too very important. Not to touch the structure, neither the process. So the structure and the process has remained more or less, you know, archaic. Now, for example, you know, I give the example a lot of times. The process is so heavily, it's broad, you know, bureaucratic. This is one example. I think you can make it understand. Like if I'm working in the field level administration, I'm an assistant commissioner. The big boss in my is my office boss, deputy commissioner of the superintendent of police or the, you know, agriculture department. Now, there's something called the earned leave. We got what it calls casual leave, and it was earned leave. We get, you know, this.
So how do you earn? How do you spell that?
Earned.
Earned
leave.
E-A-R-N-E-D.
Yeah, earned leave. E-A-R-N-E-D, earned leave. Now, earned leave is, you know, number of days that you put in service, number of days is, you know, it goes to your leave account every year. Now, for medical reasons, or for studying, or for, you know, going abroad, if that casual leave is, you know, 10 days, 20 days, you know, if you get want to have more leave, if you apply for earned leave, usually you apply, then your boss says, okay, then send this to the next tire and goes to the next tire, then it lands at the ministry. I ask the question, well, there's a lot of transaction costs involved in the stupid thing. Because to get this early, what do you require? You earn two things, that you have leave in your account, okay, and your boss is willing to let you go. Ask my colleagues, are there more things than that? Then they scratch their heads and says, no, actually no. So then I ask the question, why do you require for your leave application to be, you know, come from the district office to the divisional office, to the divisional office to the ministry? Okay, the answer they come up with, well, the ministry is your appointing authority. Then I point out to them, well, they actually appointing the authority of civil service is the President of Bangladesh. Okay, see, our appointment is done by the President, but that appointment is delegated to the ministry. The ministry on behalf of the President appoints us. If that can be done, why a stupid thing like leave cannot be delegated at the local level, decentralized to the local level? Because it is the local boss who decides that, you know, well, I'll let you go on leave. And the other thing is that you have to have leave in your account. You don't need any other thing. The ministry, the Secretary of Ministry of Establishment has no business poking his nose in that. Because I'm working in a field office. But he has to come to the ministry. So that's an example of how things really work in process orientation. I hope I've been able to hear.
No, that makes sense. So I wanted to ask about pay policy within the civil service. So what is pay policy like in the Bangladeshi civil service?
Quite stupid. It's based on your rank, not on your performance. It's based on rank and scale. Okay, not based on performance. And there's, you know, something called the increment that, you know, based on the scale, you get an increment of, maybe 200 or 300 takas or 500 or 600 takas added every year, irrespective of how much work you're doing. So person who's sitting on his backside all the time and person who's really toiling away will get the same increment. So it's not performance related at all. So there's no incentive that way. And it's not at par with the private sector at all. And, one of the reasons of corruption, I don't really agree with that, that, you know, people point out in the civil services that they're low paid. Well, that's not, you know, actually true. They're low paid, but the corruption also comes from, I think, there's a lot of scope for you to take discretion, you know, you have a lot of discretion to take decisions on your own. And there's no accountability. So corruption also creeps in that. Pay is one of the factors, not the factor. But pay is low, basically. Yep. Pay is low. So that adds to the low morale. And saying, hey, what is going to happen? You know, who's going to, if I work, what's going to happen? I'm going to do the same pay as a guy who's not doing any work. Mm. Okay. So I mean, that's a big motivation factor.
So what other accountability links like? How does accountability work within the public service?
There's very little accountability. It's very little. I mean, people are clamoring for accountability now. I mean, there's very little accountability. There's no accountability for what you do, what you don't do. So it's still, you know, based on a traditional system. Yeah. And you know, and the politicians will ask civil servants to be accountable for their deeds. So that's another big problem, I suppose. It's not performance-based, it's not target-oriented. So how do you make them accountable? They can come up with a question, what I've done is based on the law and blah, 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 and process and stuff like that.
And do you think that there are particular aspects of the civil service that are particularly Bangladeshi? Are there aspects of Bangladeshi culture that affect the
civil
service?
Well, like
rights?
All developing countries' bureaucracy, there are... Well, cultural aspects of, you know, within this civil service, there are, I mean, like all developing countries, there are cultural aspects that, you know, really affect how you operate. The concept of, you know, helping out the family, the concept of, you know, helping out, that is there. I mean, it's probably there in all developing countries, I suppose. It's not actually the Weberian model as such. It's not an ideal world. So it's there. It's obviously there. I mean, it's there, and I think all developing countries have this problem.
What are the most important reforms that are needed within the civil service at the moment?
What kind of reforms are needed?
Well, most urgently and immediately.
If you ask me to prioritize, it's basically both structural and procedural. Okay, structural is, you see, you have to, ministries are doing certain things that you shouldn't be doing. Ministries are only for policy making. If the ministries get involved in, you know, posting and transfer of a minor official or a college teacher or a school teacher, the ministry is not supposed to do that. The ministries are supposed to give policy directions. But ministries get bogged down in all those processes. They shouldn't be doing that. I'll give you another example. You see, there's a ministry called Civil Aviation and Tourism in Bangladesh. Now, this ministry issues licenses and renews licenses for the, you know, airline, what do you call this, travel agents. Okay? Interestingly, previously the travel agents could go to the ministry and apply there. Now, with the restrictions in the entry of the ministries nowadays, they can't go and apply in person. They send it by post, and the packages get lost, and they suffer. I told the other day, that look, why do the ministry need to do this thing? They can be delegated to someone else, subcontract it out, or, you know, delegate to a minor office and do it. Because people, the clientele cannot enter the ministry. How are you going to serve them? Because I know a case where, you know, the form has been sent, it has been received, it got lost. Now this chap, the private sector individual, is shouting that I have sent it by registered post, I have got proof that I received it. It's not my headache where how it got lost. The minister is saying that I don't have the document, I cannot renew your license. It become a catch-22 situation. Now in the first place, the ministry should not have been doing that, because people don't get direct access to the ministry. It would have been delegated somewhere else. So most ministries are doing something they shouldn't be doing. Not something, most of the things they shouldn't be doing. Should be delegation. Okay. And so there should be structural reforms, in the sense that, you know, delegate authority where it's needed. And then the process should be, the process should be reworked. I mean, let the people within the ministry come up with ideas how to reform the process. It has been done in Malaysia, it has been done in Singapore. I mean, the consultant knows less than what the bureaucracy does. Let them come up with ideas how to do it in a much more simpler way within their regular framework. That kind of reforms is necessary right now. You ask the minister, if you remember that when Clinton came to power, states, the reforms that was done within Al Gore at the head, they asked the different departments to identify rules that need to be thrown out. Okay, same kind of thing could be, you know, done in the context of Bangladesh. You ask the departments what needs to be done. What needs to be done? But, you know, mind you, there's a different catch to this. The way it worked in America might not work here. It's, you know, you have to say that what you need to do to deliver this kind of service. It has to be there. Because it worked in America, because the American bureaucracy, by that time in the 90s, they started to realize that they have to serve the citizens better. But this is something that, you know, realization is there, but not to that extent. So, I mean, if you want to do that, you have to tell what do you need to change in order to do this? Or what do you need to require to change if you want to this kind of target out, you know, fulfillment? Then it might work. So, I mean, it has to be homegrown, I agree, but the process needs to be trimmed. It's really ridiculous for, you know, someone applying for an earned leave at the field level to go to all the stages. It doesn't really make any sense at all. It doesn't make any sense at all.
So have you been involved at all, or are you familiar with the MAT 2?
You know, I was a participant of MAT 1.
And how is that? How did MAT 1 work out?
Well, MAT 1, it was a good program in the sense that it gave a lot of ideas to the people. I remember, I mean, my experience of MAT 1 is, I was a junior most because I was serving at the training academy there. So I went as a faculty member. And all of them were seniors. I have been telling them these things work out there. I mean, this is a... So when they, after they had this, they, you know, went to UK and they saw firsthand how things were working down there. They said, hey, you did mention these things when we were back here. I said, yes, you didn't listen to me then. Well, some of the MAT 1 participants are now very senior civil servants. Like the cabinet secretary now is a MAT 1 participant. Many secretaries are also MAT 1 participants. I think they realize the need, they do realize that change is needed. But the problem at MAT 1 was there was not big ownership. If you look, I think there is a write-up on why things didn't work right on MAT 1. I think there was not a big ownership of the government to allow the, you know, change agents to really work. Okay, I mean, the government should be in a position to allow people to bring about changes. The MAT 1 had this, you know, small progress that changes needed to, which sort of a change agents. The MAT 1 didn't really work well because those changes were not allowed to happen. There was not too much ownership from the government side on that. And MAT 2 is a bit different. Structured, but they are asked to, you know, come up with PIPs themselves.
Those are performance improvement plans.
Yeah. But I'm not too sure because those things are too minor to be really bring about the changes. You know, I've been asking the training center to really ask ministries what kind of PIPs they need instead of the participants saying this is what I'm. Because what happens in the participants come up with something very easy. Okay, they can, you know, work on. But that does not really necessarily mean this really is going to, you know, add value to the whole reform process. It might have a very marginal value. The way I would have, well, maybe I'm thinking I would have done it. Maybe another way of seeing it is that let the ministry identify what kind of changes they think are necessary, and let the participants work on that. You know, have maybe consultations in that. That is going to have ownership on part of the department ministries, and then you have a sense of direction on the participants. I don't think some MAT 2 is working on these things. But I hear a lot of positive things about MAT, but I've got serious doubts how far they're going to add value.
And do you think that's because it's driven by donors?
Possibly this is also driven by the donors, and also there should be greater ownership within the civil service to own these reforms. That's also true. I mean, MAT too is also, I think, is adding to the capacity building a lot. But does it really help us to generate that, critical mass? That's the question I have right now. But, I'm a MAT participant. I'm not a participant of MAT too, so I really don't know. But, you can ask this question to very senior civil servants who have been participants of MAT 1. I mean, they can tell you what's really happening down there.
Do you think that so this is to change tracks a little bit, but yep. Do you think that the Bangladeshi civil service has the skills to implement reforms that are needed?
Yes and no. In the sense that there are people who are quite capable, but they need to be retrained in certain aspects to allow the changes to happen. Okay. And the no side is a lot of resistance within the bureaucracy for any kind of changes. So he's got a yes and no facet to it. But, I think the number of yes people are growing day to day. And if you reskill the civil servants to act in different ways, there's a possibility that things might work out. But, it has to be prioritized. This one first, and this one, and this one, and this one. See, there's a lot of talk about a lot of things, but nothing happens. That's the problem with Bangladesh. You'll hear it a lot among all the... You see, a lot of interesting ideas are there, but nothing happens to those ideas. If someone says, okay, these are three ideas I'm going to implement for the next 10 years, 2 years, that's the first step. And then you go to the next priority, that's the next priority. A lot of talk about doing things that nothing's really happening. Nobody's going to. Well, I say it like this: is who's going to bell the cat? I'm taking the first step ahead. That's my understanding of the whole process. I would agree there are people who are out there who come to a sort of a screening process. They are capable, but they need to be retrained in the new techniques. And also to be able to rethink of their positions. I can give you one example. I was teaching a class the other day of mid-level people. When I was asking them, I says, what I finally told them bluntly, like, if you guys don't change, your own existence will be at stake 10 years, 5 years down the line. Because if you can't deliver, the private sector is going to take over. Okay. Or the civil society is going to take over. I told them, look at the ODA that has gone to the civil society, the NGOs since 1989.
The what? The
Official Development Assistance. Okay. Most of its flows now flows through the non-government sector. Because the government sector is not capable enough to do that. Okay, I told them bluntly, if you chaps don't shape up, you have to shape out. There's a realization, but you see what's to be done. It's. I think the government needs to take a very serious, like the Indian government is now doing. I don't know what you are aware of what the Indians are doing now. They are retraining the civil servants from the mid-level, senior level, the very senior level, to cope with the challenges that India faces today. As very junior officials are allowed to go out and study and come back. Well, I would ask, what is the amount of money that Bangladesh government invests in training civil servants? Very minimum. The Bangladesh government does not invest a lot in training of civil servants. Because, whereas the armed forces invest a lot. The Indians and the Pakistanis on the other side are allowing and give funding civil servants to go and study abroad. Come back and do the work. Okay. The pay has gone up. Now, at the same time, they have this mid-term, small-term, lot of trainings spread out through the career that one gets pick up skills. They have this training with American universities and locally in Indian institutes for mid-level people. They have this training with Harvard and Institute of Management in Ahmedabad, to train out very senior civil servants. They have this training with Lal Bahadur Shastri Academy, the Sirik School, Maxwell School, and KDI to serve mid-level people, different skills. This is not something that we are not doing. And probably, if you ask me why it's not happening, it's donors have somehow or other abundant in civil service capacity building. I don't know why. I mean, they keep harping on them that the civil servants are, you know, not trained. But you know how far they're investing, except DFID, they're not really investing a lot in civil service capacity building. There's no use harping on that if you don't really help out. Well, I mean, I suppose the donors can put down the foot and say, well, to the government, this funding does not come through to you of a big project if you do not retrain your civil servants. None of the donors have said that.
So I wonder, do you think donors would be able to push the government to act?
The donors have tried, but they have not really tried hard enough, I suppose. See, I mean, the example I gave you, if the donors say, well, I will not give you money for this energy project until unless you revamp your energy sector civil service, retrain them. They have not been able to, because donors have an agenda of their own. They have to spend money. That's a different ball game. It's a different racket. So, I mean, donors have not been persistent, from my analysis. They have not been persistent in capacity building. I'll give an example. World Bank, which set up the public administration center back in the 80s, did not contribute anything to capacity building of civil servants for the area. Well, they came up with an excuse when I was trying to push it, when I was in ERD. They said the government doesn't listen to us. Well, there are times when the government listens to the World Bank when the World Bank puts down its feet and says, I'm not going to give you money if you don't do that. In this case, I think donors have not been strong enough to do that. So there are possibilities the donors can force the government to bring some changes of capacity building. And then they can, I think, also help the government to enhance the capacity of civil servants. And then the government also should spend some money into that. You know, they cannot look at the donors all the while and say, we need, you know, look at the heavenwards and say, we will expect money. They should have an ownership of what's really happening. The Indians have, they're spending money on their own to groom up the civil service. They have realized that you need to meet the challenges, you have to change them.
Do you think there are small areas where reforms could be tried by particular secretaries, joint secretaries, district commissioners?
Look, if there's one way of looking at it. If people, well, I'll give you another story. One of the seniors, civil servants, who was an academic, also had an academic bent, I remember. He used to keep up with two things. In the civil service, when you enter the civil service, this thing is turned off and this thing is pulled out. This thing is turned off.
Head is turned off.
Turned off, and then your backbone is pulled off.
Okay.
So, I mean, well, if the senior secretaries are given a leeway of saying, look, you become an innovator, you're trying to bring about some things, and the government, that innovation is recognized by the government, I think it's going to work.
So what would happen if a secretary were to try something?
Secretaries don't try, because if things don't work, they get blamed for it.
Okay. So they're afraid of... They're afraid of making mistakes.
Well, mistakes are a part of the learning process. One has to realize that.
But they're afraid of making them.
Yes. But if they given the chance, I think some of them would be able to do that. I think some of them should be able to do that. Let's see how it tries. If you try to make the emanation, let's see how it tries. But they get blamed for a lot of happenings. It's possible. It's not impossible. I don't think it's a totally impossible is the word I took right now. But you know, you have to give them some leeway that you try things, we're going to help you out. What kind of resources are we going to give you? Bring some changes. Okay, that's going to work, I suppose. But that message has to be clearly spelled out by the politicians. Otherwise, the bureaucracy is not going to work. See, the senior bureaucracy. There's another factor working there. I don't know whether you're aware that after 20, 25 years of service, If you put in 25 years, the government can kick you out any time without any citing reasons.
So it can remove you?
Yeah. So that is the reason most of the senior secretaries have put in 25 years. So they are...
So where would you normally be on your career path after 25 years?
Well, you should have become a secretary by that time.
Okay.
Should have. You know, 25 years or plus. Okay. Most of the secretaries right now have been 25 years. 25 years plus of service, maybe more. Many of them are retiring or something. So they're always under the assumptions that if things don't work, I get picked up. I can become an OSD, Officer and Special Duty. So they are risk averse. Okay, they don't want to take risks. And I think this has to be a political understanding should be there that, you know, people should be allowed to take risks, to at least change things. Otherwise, if you don't take risks, changes will not happen. I mean, if you look at the Malaysian case, Malaysia has taken years to bring about changes. The Indians have started later on, but the Indians have started carrying out reforms. And the bureaucracy now is in tune of how things are supposed to work differently. But unfortunately, in the context of bureaucracy, nothing has happened. It's a number of, I think the reasons are two. It's resistance within bureaucracy at one time, and a complete lack of political will to push for changes. And that's, if they are the two major factors one would find.
Okay. Do you have anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
No. If you have, if you need anything else, I can always help you out later on, I suppose.
Great, thank you very much.
I hope I've been helped to you.